Hawaiian missionary Gladys Lewis. I have been in church-related positions. However, my real vocation is not church-related, it is the church. Since my conversion at age 17, about 5 years ago, my life has been spent in an absorbing involvement in all phases of my local church, wherever I have been geographically. The church is where we begin and end. We are nurtured and matured to hear a call to prepare to return to minister. Whatever we do in terms of church relatedness as vocations must be in perspective with the priority system, with the priority scale and the value system of the church itself and the will of the Father. How do we attain a balance between our church vocations, our church-related vocations, the church's priority scale, a system and value, priority scale and value system, and the will of the Father? We do it by the definition, acceptance, and use of power as that affects women, men, and ministry through the creation, crucible, and crusade that we encounter in our pilgrimage. The Bible background for our exploration is Judges chapters 4 and 5. Deborah is the only woman in the Bible who was placed at the height of political power by common consent of the people. Few women in history have attained the public dignity and supreme authority of Deborah, the judge, prophetess, and warrior. She was a mother in Israel and the wife of a man named Lapidoth, a word meaning torches. The rabbis say she was a keeper of the tabernacle lamps early in her life. This would indicate that she and her husband were Levites. She became the receptacle for a spiritual vision that relighted all of Israel. She counseled her people, ruled in their disputes, and delivered them in war. The key to her great leadership was an implicit faith in God, with the ability to inspire in others that same kind of trust. The key to her success in leadership was knowing what to do with power from her own person, Barak, her people, her enemies, and God. We all exert power in some form. Our adjustment and contribution as happy and productive members of the family of the Father depend on how we define, accept, and use our power. First point, creation. Creation is diverse. There is the divine creation of earth, plant, animal, and human life. There is the creation that we share communally by being created with spirit and intelligence as men and women. There is actual physical creation of a human being by two other humans and the developing of that person through the creative forces of childhood and experience. There is the creation that we perform on ourselves by right and proper choices, which add to the sum of what we are becoming. Creation is added to us by being creators, that is, by the creativity we possess to do, to be, and to work. Creation is past, present, and future. Our unique place in it is nullified if we do not in some way become aware of our own power. First statement, creation occurs when we define our power in relation to our abilities. Individual power is anchored in God and emanates from that source. Inception or beginning is in Him, and all orientations evolve from that relationship. That creative beginning for women in the local church comes most often in accomplishing expected and unexpected responsibilities in a faithful manner. Deborah didn't awake one day with Judge tacked over her palm tree. She was created by a process of faithfulness to opportunities in her immediate sphere of service that took her from lamp polisher to commander-in-chief. My first assignment in public speaking is not this occasion today. Rather, it was a training union part as a nervous teenager in a Baptist church in Oklahoma. We define our power by discovering our abilities. My practice and experience as a WMUer helped me to define my power as an administrator and planner. My tenure as treasurer of a mission church gave me a working knowledge of finance, so I'm at home with budget studies in larger boards and committees. There is no better laboratory for learning than the local church, especially for women, because historically we have not had access to other ways to define our power. Second statement, creation occurs when we define our power in relation to others. Deborah had enormous power, but she knew her limits. Barak, her captain, had power, also with limits. He asked only for that which he knew was essential to complement his strength, her presence, and her power. Creation is not complete unless men and women work together. An absolute component in defining power is that we are essential to the task of each other. I read and hear a great deal about the Genesis account of creation, and that's good to know. We need to know that because it's in the Bible and we're people of the book. Beyond its being a good thing to know, basic, like one and one or two, it's also a good way for people to hang labels on each other. And I have one recurring question. What difference does it make, practically? In all my years around hospitals, I have never heard parents of twins make an issue of which one was born first. It isn't even mentioned. Twins are two individuals, and one came out first, but that in no way diminishes the importance of one in the love and esteem of the father and mother. I know that God, my Father, does not consider me and my place in church and society with less regard because the first human in creation was male. To assign to one kind of the Father's children greater importance because of being born first is to fly in the face of biblical teaching about the nature of God, the Father. I am his child, a daughter, and as such I have ascribed to me the same degree of responsibility for love and faithfulness to him as does Wilbur, my husband, likewise a child, who is a son. In the past, the power of woman has been defined in relation to man. We cannot ignore the social shaping of culture and society. But woman must define her power and relate her creation to God first before relating it to others, or ultimately it is not her power. The strength that comes from recognizing the proper sequence of definition and relating grant us power in the work that we do together. Third statement, creation occurs when we define our power with a reasonable balance between risk and security. Deborah examples this. The entire system of priests and prophets reflect the balance between risk and security. The priests showed the certain way. The prophets called out a thunderous no and pointed in another direction. Deborah, as prophet and woman, added another dimension of risk, but her people responded in a positive fashion. Risk and security create a tension for living that is in itself a test of power definition. Some practical aids are available that add prestige to power. When we consistently finish what we start, we create security in the midst of risk. The nuns who ran my nursing school hammered this principle into my life philosophy. They never gave us one jot more than was necessary to do a job. One of my most humiliating life experiences was misreading a surgery card and cutting the suture in thirds instead of halves for my favorite gynecologist. We did an entire cesarean section with shorter suture than he wanted because the nun wouldn't give me any more. After surviving that, no other cesarean section ever held any risk for me. Respect for the attitudes of other people soothed the fear involved in risk. A very ordinary way we show disrespect and increase risk and suspicion is by our appearance. We have had such an emphasis on personal freedom, we have been negligent of the effect of our own looseness and self-creation that it has on other people. I wear blue jeans most of the time at home, but if I wore them to a board meeting at Southwestern Seminary and stood to promote a policy change, I think my idea would be viewed with risk. I doubt that I would be taken seriously. Consistent spiritual input is a must for balancing risk and security. The only time I went to the Bible for one of those on-the-spot, open-the-book-to-a-page answers was after a distressing argument with my son over a haircut when we were in the long hair arena of the parent-child battlefield. The Bible fell open to Ecclesiastes 2, and my eyes found verse 19, quote, "And who can tell whether my son will be a wise man or a fool?" "And yet all I have will be given to him. How discouraging." I needed hope more than agreement. So I went back to methodical study for solutions. Consistent spiritual input adds credibility in the midst of risk and creates a security that underlines the existence of power. Second point, crucible. A step beyond creation in the definition of power is crucible, the acceptance of power. It is difficult to realize the potential of power without the refiner's fire of the crucible. First statement, when we accept the power, we accept the responsibility for the crucible. Deborah and Barak knew their power, and when they accepted it, they undertook the responsibility for their crucible, the awesome battle with Sisera's host. Many crucibles have been mine. I will tell you of one in particular, the growth of my self-image as a woman with a call to ministry. My call from God was dramatic and indelible. My surrender was complete and without reservation. My appointment service for the mission field was a commissioning, a setting apart, as in Acts 13:3. Women on my field worked side by side with men who were glad to have them. Part of my crucible was the dilemma and struggle in the pain and frustration with laying aside the call with the resignation from the place. The Holy Spirit has helped me understand the reason for the confusion. My call has not been revoked. I just have a new place and new ways to do it. We returned to the United States to the full-blown heights of the women's movement. I listened to what was being said and proposed in regard to what women could and could not do in church. I did not marry, bury, or baptize anybody on the mission field, but I did everything else. And our little church prospered for it. I'm a serious Christian. If I eat meat and it causes my brother or my sister to stumble, I'm willing to quit. I meditated, studied, and finally decided on the truthfulness of a profound thought of mine, which was, some of my brothers and sisters are flaky. They are extremely scriptural, but not very biblical. The symbol that has come to be a crucible for most people, whatever their particular view of it, is ordination. There are two ways that success in ministry is recognized in a Baptist church. I speak of the practical way, not what we hold up as ideal, but the two ways that success in ministry is recognized. One is by ordination, and the other is by giving a harder job to do. And my recognition has always been in the latter category. Of course, this does not preclude that many times both are given. A year ago, at the time of the annual deacon election in my church, several families asked me if they could submit my name on the ballot. We had never had a woman deacon, but women's names had been on the ballot. I had never sensed in my church the antagonism that I knew was present in other places. I prayed about the request, talked with my husband and my pastor. I accepted the responsibility for the crucible and said yes to the request. I want to digress to say something. My husband has a silly way of posing when we take pictures, and he makes a strange munching sound back in his jaws when he chews, and he can shake the foundations with his snoring. But I love him so much. I love my church that way. My church won't get all fired up about missions, won't observe all the denominational programs, and there's absolute foot dragging in some areas, but I love that church. It is the tangible, living reality of the family of God for me on the corner of Kitty Hawk and Rickenbacker in Midwest City. I'm committed to them and they to me. So if you go out from here to say I badmouth my church, you're in error. And I shall, in Sherlock Holmesian fashion, track you down and sue you for libel. I simply share with you the crucible they were to me and I was to them. Because, statement two, when we accept the power, we accept the pain of the crucible. As the election drew near, I realized how seriously I had misjudged my church family. But by then, withdrawal would have been more harmful than the playing out of the trauma. So I fastened my safety belt and endured to the end. No woman was elected. After a few days, when my sense of humor began to return, I thought of writing an article about the episode, but did not, because I could not decide whether I should entitle it, "The Whole Armor of God is Not a Double-Breasted Suit." Or, "The Day We Did a Mastectomy on the Breastplate of Righteousness." Instead, I wrote a letter to my pastor, and I will read you part of it. Quote, "My personal injury lay exactly where you said my primary concern should be, at the feet of the principal that was involved. There's no way I can separate myself from being what I am, a female. I am eminently and totally fulfilled as a woman. My happiness and joy in being me increase as I grow and become older. That was part of the wound. All my life, I have faced this reality. No matter how well I perform, no matter how excellent my work, there is always in the final scene a closed door, and I'm not allowed to enter." Wilbur finally understood how it was I took it personally when I put it to him in terms of his love of surgery and devotion to medicine. "I think for you it must be the creation and delivery of sermons. Say that you do what you do with the love for it you have. But women are the ones who are in the majority professionally in what you do. They show evidence of liking you, appreciate your work, put you on special committees to help them, and in most cases you feel free and at ease. But these women who are your colleagues have a professional sorority. For Wilbur, I called it the American College of Surgeons. And they have a rule that says all members must be female. And the rule is not even mentioned until your name is proposed for membership. You sit, listen, and wonder how you, a capable male, would contribute to the decay of the group if you were admitted to the sorority. You have lived your life to further the principles of the sorority, but your motives are brought into question at the very point of your primary priority commitment, and all because you do not have the sexual property specified in the rule for membership. I dare say the principle is exactly what would hurt you most at the personal level. You really are El Buen Pastor, the Good Shepherd, you know? This black sheep is able to survive and thrive because you feed me so well as you are looking after the flock. During this episode, to quote Isaiah, you gathered me in your arms and carried me in your bosom, and I reckon that qualifies you for membership in my sorority, so anytime you want in, it's okay." End quote. Third statement. When we accept the power, we accept the resolution of the crucible. I had experienced pain, but I had also caused pain. People as devout as I had opposite views in the matter. It became my conviction to enter actively into resolution of the crucible. I did this by overt and private acts, gestures to assure people of my love and my care for them. One by one, they did that healing act for me in return. When we function in the expanding crucible, we do hurt each other, even as growing families do. But unresolved pain is a hindrance to health and growth, and we are each responsible for resolving that. There is symbolic power and there is real power. I was denied the former, but gifted with the latter in the intervening year in terms of serious responsibility in places of importance in my church. I believe that came to me because I've been able to execute successfully my share of the resolution of the crucible. Ordination has never been of consequence or a determining factor in the expression of my call, but I've thought a great deal about it this year. Nobody seems to win. Ordination in its positive symbolism is significant to those who ordain and are ordained. When it is withheld, it has negative symbolism, which also becomes significant. We Baptists pride ourselves on the concept of the priesthood of the believer, but it seems to me at the emotional and belief level, we must hold to something different, or it would not be the issue that it is. The choice for women seems to lie somewhere between being a martyr or being martyred. If a woman feels she should be ordained for her particular ministry but doesn't seek it, she's criticized and rejected by men and women who think she should. If she does seek it, she's criticized and rejected by those who oppose it. If she seeks it and fails, she feels criticism and rejection from her church. If she seeks it and succeeds, she's criticized and rejected by the larger arena and becomes suspect. This particular dilemma will probably be solved finally only in the crucible that always has resolution. Time. Third point, crusade. Crusade evokes an image of armies going to battle or masses of people united to realize a stated goal. Crusades can be small, private, quiet, ignored, frustrating. Crusade is any time we extend beyond ourselves to actualize some remedial effort. First statement, when we use our power in crusade, change results. When we stand in our crusade, change is as inevitable as aging and often just about as welcome. Change is frightening, both to the one who causes it and to the one who is observing it. When Deborah and Barak went out to use their power in their crusade against the enemy, radical change took place. Change for good needs to be tempered so that as many as possible affirm its effects. Many of us pursue our crusades too fondly and vigorously and behave as did John Wesley, who, when riding horseback with a man to Northampton, got into an argument about religion, to quote Wesley, upon which he would have gladly run away outright. But being the better mounted of the two, I kept close to his side and endeavored to show him his heart till we came into the street of Northampton. Change produces anxiety even though it is anticipated. My baby started to junior high school this fall. For the past 6 years, she's never bathed, shampooed, or brushed her teeth without protesting she'd done it the week before. Within 2 days of the start of school, she had shampooed and curled her hair 4 times, polished her nails, rearranged her furniture, and put up the poster of John Travolta who leers down at me from her wall. I knew this would happen, but was shocked when it did. And I mourn for my baby while I greet the growth signs with joy. The change in the economics of today's world no longer allows us the luxury of servants. We don't have them at home, and women, long the servants at church, are no longer available for that function. Excellence is sometimes lost when there are no servants. I find it hard to do alone the formal dinners for large groups I have done in the past with help. It is difficult for the present volunteer workforce at my church to do all the WMU service tasks. I recently went to a 25-year reunion of my nursing school class. The sisters are no longer distinguishable from us. They wore street clothes as we did, and we realized that female bodies had been beneath the black habits of yesteryear. They are women, as we are, and the former nomenclature of nun and student is gone. As I contemplated the eradication of the visible differences between the nuns and me, I think I understood for the first time some of the opposition to the women's movement. Their comfort and security in holy, set-apart, clearly defined servant people, whether they are nuns, priests, ministers, missionaries, or women. It is easier to see God when the godly are segregated. There's a scariness in all of us being mortal with clay feet. Changes in life bring changes in attitude. Although we may not want or welcome change, we accept the reality of the change. In a questionnaire on the attitudes toward the role of women in church and society released through the Home Mission Board in October of 77, overwhelming percentages of those questioned disapproved of overt minister roles for women, but 66% felt that attitudes toward women in ministry would change within the next 25 years. Second statement, when we use our power in crusade, opposition polarizes. Sisera quickly marshaled his forces when he knew Deborah and Barak were marching against him. No matter what your view or position on anything, your opponent is out there waiting, even before you express your opinion and direct your strength. But we are all necessary with our differing thoughts. In God's kingdom, there is no one position so unimportant that it should be omitted, and no one position so important it cannot be omitted. John Dunn was certainly right in saying that no one is an island. When one is diminished, we are all diminished. It follows then that there is inordinate power in our diversity. I bring my own flavor and savor to a task. It won't be the same without my gifts, yet it can survive without me. When we had been gone from Paraguay 4 years, we returned for a visit. To our utter amazement, the medical and evangelistic work had gone on without us. The work was, in fact, thriving, and yet our mark was in it. There is a sense in which we are all replaced, as well as a sense in which no one can be replaced. It is not logical, therefore, in the economy of the kingdom to dissipate our communal strength in confrontations that are not constructive or hostilities that have no hope. Third statement, when we use our power in crusade, ministry is focused. A crusade is just a protest unless ministry takes place. Mission is our goal. Vision is our view of the task. What happens while we are expressing our vision en route to the mission is ministry. Deborah and Barak had their ministry focused in their crusade. An expression of it is in chapter 5, verse 12. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, utter a song. Arise, Barak, and lead thy captivity captive. Men and women have been ministering in Baptist churches as long as there have been churches. But women in ministry, as we are gearing ourselves to think in the present and in the future, involves many additional concepts. And the defining of that ministry must take place at local church level and at the level of denominational institutions. The defining usually comes about in reaction to a given situation and thereby has absent from it the forward thrust that most women with a sense of call to ministry would like to have as a security base from churches and denomination. As local churches grant positions and recognition to women, they signal similar behavior to denominational entities, and these entities can have immense effects on attitudes in additional churches by being models of recognizing responsible women with positions commensurate with their skills, as we heard from this platform last night. Another aspect of focus of ministry is the tediousness of it. There are repetition and monotony in work and ministry, whatever it is, whosoever it is. The tedium is countered by the worth attached to it by church and society. Women have not had enough worth placed on their repetitious acts to make the fulfillment scale balance. There's a fragile line between the performance of ministry and the paralysis of minutia. My call from God is to ministry through all avenues that I have open to me. Basic in my response is creativity and dignity. I will serve, but I cannot withstand the tediousness of ministry unless I feel worth and acceptance in my performance, be it great or insignificant. That performance must carry my mark, my print, my creative urge. Christ gives me his resource, strength, and example of faithfulness in the face of the routine and the ordinary. He renews my vision and dissipates the tiredness of tedium. Part of the focus of ministry is to determine how much of the power defined and accepted can be used. Lack of acceptance cancels power. Focusing ministry also helps in determining if we have defined, accepted, and used more power than is really ours. Power is controlled and motivated in the purest sense by love. When ministry is in focus, we will love. Any weaknesses in our credentials will be covered by that love that is reciprocal between us and people. Impeccable expression of ministry is for nothing without love. So we conclude by repeating the beginning. Through our salvation from the Father, the church is where we begin and end. Christ said, "All power is given me in heaven and earth." He told us, "But you shall receive power after the Holy Ghost is come upon you." We incorporate that power through the creative experience of defining it, the suffering crucible of accepting it, and the crusade endeavor of using it. In the creation of definition, we know our power in relation to our abilities, other people, and a reasonable balance between risk and security. In accepting that power, we accept the responsibility, the pain, and the resolution of the crucible. When we advance to the use of the power, we enter into crusade that affects change, polarization of opposition, and focusing of ministry. Creation, crucible, crusade. God said to Deborah and Barak, awake, arise. Awake to your strength. Arise to use your power. God says to us, awake to what you have. Arise to your potential. Awake, Deborah, Barak, arise. Awake, woman, man, arise. Awake, awake, arise, arise. Awake, arise.
A little over a year ago, when the pastor of the First Baptist Church in San Antonio, Texas, Dr. Jimmy Allen, was elected president of the Southern Baptist Convention, the press pinned him right away on the women's issue. He gave the most courageous statement I had heard any person of his type make publicly at that time. If the president of the Southern Baptist Convention had not said that, I don't know whether we would have had him here or not. But since he did, we do. And I join you in welcoming him to our lectern at this time.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I appreciate the chance to respond. I'm not sure that a man of my type, it's a person of my type, can do so, but I'll do my best. Last night I heard a good bit of talk about where political power is in Southern Baptist life. And I was very proud of myself for being very quiet during that time and allowing all the agency people to answer. I came back today, though, to start out by telling you how it works. Since the buck stops on my desk at this moment, I have about 7 more months to be the elected leader of the Southern Baptist Convention. This year, for the first time now, the convention committees reflect my judgment along with the 2 vice presidents who are elected. We have a very slow process in order to keep stability in a movement as broad, as based in local church life, as unworkable and from any kind of organizational chart you can possibly figure out, and as workable as it is in the strength the Southern Baptists have become. So there is a very slow process for the selection of committees and boards and the turnover in boards. But the process is that a year after a president is elected, he and his 2 vice presidents select the committee on committees. They're bound by constitution to have 1 ordained person and 1 who is not in a church-related vocation from each state who become the committee on committees. That committee on committees then in turn selects a couple of committees beside the committee on boards, but the important one for your questioning is the committee on boards. They in turn will nominate a person who is ordained and one who is not involved in a church-related vocation. Those 2 people from that state then become responsible on the committee on boards for the nomination of the people from that state convention who will be coming on to various boards and of the agencies of the Southern Baptist Convention. There is a rotation system, a kind of a system of eligibility, which slows down the process of the number of vacancies on any one board. Since any institution wants to keep some stability and some people who have experience and insight in order to keep from having to teach everybody the how the thing runs every year and thereby let all the power instead of most of the power be in the hands of the executives. And so in order to do that, there has to be some rotation system so that the vacancies of that committee that committee faces will be the ones that they particularly have from their state at that time. Once in a while, somebody doesn't show up at the meeting from some other state, and you can drop somebody in that you had in mind. Now, in the process, the president, in consultation with 2 vice presidents, set up this committee on committees, recommended to the convention in its first session, and then it functions. That committee on boards then doesn't function until the next year. So this year, the committee on boards is a result of the committee on committees that the president and the 2 vice presidents appointed in the Atlanta convention. The next year, I will be appointing a committee on committees in the same fashion in February, and write it down, February is the time. You can write me a letter, send me a bio sheet on anybody that you would like to have considered in that process. That doesn't mean it's automatic that I'm going to put them on there. I have some choices of my own. I have some relationships with some people who have been forwarding programs that I believe in, and that's a part of the political process. I am looking for people who are qualified I am trying to find folks who are qualified basically in their understanding of the denomination and the resources of personnel in that state, because it doesn't do any good to be in there male or female if you don't know what you're doing, you know. And so we're looking for folks who know the folks in that state and who have some of the basic things that I think Southern Baptists are trying to get done now, mainly the bold mission thrust. The people we're looking for are folks who are involved and who are committed to that direction. We're not going to consider somebody who's got other axes to grind if we can keep from it, because that's the direction that we feel affirmed by the convention to go in at this time. I had problems last time, basically because any president and any two vice presidents have problems knowing enough people across a national convention to be able to find the best, most able people to put on any committee. And then I ran into some problems when I got some interpretations that people who teach on college faculties, for instance, are church-related if they are in a Baptist school. They're not church-related if they're in a non-Baptist school. I haven't figured out that yet. So, but anyway, I had to move, for instance, Sarah Frances Anders. I put her on the committee on committees and got bounced off that she couldn't do it because she teaches at Louisiana Baptist College. She didn't look like a preacher to me. I thought I could put her on there. She sounds good when she preaches, but she didn't look like one. So I have some, you know, we run into those kinds of regulations and those kinds of things. That's a part of the political process too. But I will assure you that if you send that kind of person's name to us, the president and the two vice presidents, they are Douglas Watterson, the First Baptist Church of Knoxville, Tennessee, who got elected in a famous election in Atlanta, and Bill Self of the Wyuka Road Baptist Church in Atlanta. Those are the two who are the vice presidents this year. Now, for many of you, that's taking coals to Newcastle to tell you that, but some of you have been asking, how does that work? That's the way it works, and it works both by the civics textbook and by the practical politics of interrelations of personalities. If you, it's just like any other political process. You get both the civic textbook of this is the mechanics of how it works, and then you get all the different things that happen in interrelationships that are involved in a person's trying to do the best job he can to forward the cause among Southern Baptists that he at that time feels is what God is seeking to do. And that's a part of the mantle and the responsibility, the pain and the power of leadership. In our situation, fortunately, that doesn't last very long. The president gets 2 years shot at that if he gets reelected in the middle. I got a call from Brooks Hayes the night before the election in Atlanta. It's supposed to be an automatic reelection. And Brooks called me to say, Jimmy, I just didn't want you to sleep too good. They nominated somebody against me the second time I was up. And so I went to bed worried about whether I was going to have any opposition the next day because of Brooks's careful and wonderful counsel. But anyway, that's the way that works. And the wheels of denominational gods grind very slowly indeed. And that probably is good over a long period of time. But for those of us who are impatient for change, it is awfully heavy a burden to bear that you have to wait that long to get things done. And that's not a maleness and femaleness problem. That's a problem for any of us who have any kind of philosophical point that we feel that Southern Baptists ought to be reflecting. Now, in this closing time, let me read two scriptures and then respond in my role as president of the Southern Baptist Convention to the consultation. The two scriptures that I want to read are Joel, the third chapter, the 28th verse, where the Word of God says, "And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my Spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my Spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire, and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance as the Lord hath said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call." The second passage is Matthew, the 8th chapter, the 14th verse, where the Word says, "And when Jesus was come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother laid and sick of a fever. And he touched her hand, and the fever left her. And she arose and ministered unto them."